Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, crazy, and crazy martinis for you today. We are learning, just as we're recording here on Friday morning, about another high school shooting at Santa Fe High School in Texas. We don't know a lot of the details. We are seeing reports that there are fatalities. And a lot of reports about some other things. But until we have enough information to comment intelligently about that, we are going to not speculate at this point and go to stories that we actually do have enough information on to comment intelligently. To suffice it to say, though, our prayers very much are with the families of anyone who may have been killed in this situation in Texas, and certainly for the recovery of anyone injured, and that anyone connected to the shooting would be properly taken care of by the authorities. Jim, let's go to our good martini. That is the fact that after a whole lot of back and forth and a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of concern on the right, in fact, about whether or not Gina Haspel would be confirmed as the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. On Thursday, the vote was held, and she now has been confirmed. She's the first female head of the CIA. She's a longtime intelligence community vet, 30 years, I think. She was the deputy director under Mike Pompeo. In the end, the final vote was 54 to 45. Two Republicans did vote against her. That was Rand Paul, who always was going to vote against her, and Jeff Flake of Arizona, perhaps swayed by John McCain's recommendation against Haspel in absentia. So when you take away the fact that McCain's not there and those two Republican votes, that brings it down to 48 yes votes. So you need some Democrats to get over the top, and six of them actually did vote yes. One of them was the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia. Another was Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire. And Jim, you tell me what the other four have in common. Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and Bill Nelson of Florida.
All four are running this year, and they are Democratic senators in red states, and they're all running on variations of Trump voters, please don't vote against me. See how good I can be. See, I vote for Trump nominees. See, I'm not that bad. I'm not like Chuck Schumer and all those other Senate Democrats. Greg, I believe you and I a couple times have said that Mark Warner of Virginia has a reputation for being a moderate, for being a centrist, kind of like my piece on Adam Schiff from earlier in the week, observing that that he generally ends up voting the party line. Very tough to find times where Mark Warner has really broken with his party on a significant piece. Well, you know what? Prove me wrong. Mark Warner has broken away from the rest of his party on a key nomination. I don't know whether he feels like, obviously CIA headquarters is in his home state. A lot of government workers in his home state. Maybe he feels a need to not politicize nomination fights like this, particularly for someone who's not, a longtime affiliated, Trump loyalist by any stretch of the imagination. Career agency employee, and folks who've heard me talk about this in the past say, look, when Trump puts up a good nominee, if you're a Senate Democrat, you vote for him. You have no guarantees that the next nominee, the replacement, will be any better. This is, if you didn't like Ben Carson at HUD or any of these other nominees you've seen in the White House, you got to reinforce the good decisions Trump makes, and you got to punish the bad decisions Trump makes, and this philosophy that Kirsten Gillibrand and some other Senate Democrats have decided that they're going to vote against every single Trump nominee, no matter the qualities of the candidate, no matter the standards, no matter the resume, experience, any of that kind of stuff. Well, then you're basically saying your vote doesn't matter. You're basically saying that the qualities of the nominee don't matter, and you're just going to march in lockstep opposition. And I thought that was a disservice to the Gina Haspels of the world and quite a few other nominees who aren't controversial, who don't have any serious objections here. I always felt like this was a bad time to relitigate arguments from the Bush administration. But I think over time it became even sharper clarity that if you really objected to Gina Haspel, well, why wouldn't you object to John Brennan, who was at the agency and who was, number four in ranking when the infamous waterboarding policy was in place? And many Senate Democrats didn't really have a good reason for that. They just basically decided, well, it's a Trump nominee. So these issues are heightened in the era of Trump, blah, blah, blah. Good for them. It's a victory for common sense. I just kind of would know that it's not an overwhelming victory for common sense. And it required a couple surprises like Mark Warner going our way. Also because Jeff Flake, who apparently is either mind melded with John McCain, or he's basically decided, hey, you know what? I'm not running for re-election. I can vote against anybody I want. I can be as big a thorn in the Trump administration's side. To me, there are much bigger and better and more important battles to fight if you oppose this administration than a, you know, because seriously, she's already acting director of the CIA, and she had a long, if she was rejected as director, it's not like she would go away. She would still keep working at the agency. So I don't really understand how you'd say, you know, it's okay to have her there continuing working, but we don't want her as director or something like that. So a lot more playing politics than was necessary, but the story has a happy ending for Gina Haspel.
Yeah, and let's hope that the voters in Indiana, North Dakota, West Virginia, and Florida realize that this is not necessarily something these senators would have done in a non-reelection year. So bake that into the cake. Don't assume that they're suddenly on your wavelength as a result of getting this vote right. And a couple of them also went for Mike Pompeo as well. Real quick, Jim, what do you make of Claire McCaskill? On one side, you kind of have to admire her for not trying to pander by voting no here. On the other hand, you know, she's proving herself to be a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, which should help us win the seat this year.
Yeah, I think you probably put John Tester in that category as well. He really has not. We argue about how cynical it is to see these guys shifting to the right when it's you know, when they're up for re-election. And they suddenly realize the demographics of their state are not comfortable to be voting in lockstep with Chuck Schumer. But lo and behold, here we are. And I guess, yeah, I guess you could say congratulations to Claire McCaskill. You're showing your true colors. I suppose we can salute the honesty. Maybe they just believe there's no point in it, or they feel like ultimately this isn't going to be a deciding factor in their election. It's quite likely nobody in Missouri is necessarily going to vote for their Senate on how you voted on the nomination for CIA director. Overall, though, I think if you're a Trump supporter in Missouri, and he won that state by a fairly comfortable margin, that he's going to come out and say, you know what, I'm voting against McCaskill. She votes against what Trump wants too many, way too often.
Well, let's move on to our first crazy martini now, Jim. And if there's anything conservatives want to see more of on television, it's Anthony Scaramucci and Michael Avenatti, who, of course, is the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, and apparently he's trying to dredge up some other women who allegedly received payoffs, aka hush money from President Trump at some point along the way. But now there are people trying to get the Mooch and Avenatti their own TV show. This is from the New York Times. A prominent television agent discussed with executives at CNN and MSNBC the concept of a program where the two men would square off, according to three people briefed on the issue. Both have become frequent cable news guests, Mr. Avenatti as one of Mr. Trump's greatest antagonists, and Mr. Scaramucci as a loyalist to the president, even after flaming out after less than 2 weeks at the White House. Avenatti just yesterday tweeting out, LOL, I have no interest in television right now. I'll leave that to the experts. I enjoy practicing law and look forward to prevailing on behalf of my client, Stormy Daniels. That's where my focus is. So, Jim, it's clear that this lawyer has no penchant for television cameras at all, since he's only been interviewed several times a day, it seems like, over the past couple of months. And the Mooch, of course, is no enemy to attention either. So, A, what do you make of the fact that this debacle is even being discussed? And deep down, would you actually want to watch it for at least a few minutes?
The first answer is no. the answer to the second question is no, it would not. The rumor, as annoying and frustrating as it is, does explain a few things, because Stormy Daniels comes forward, shares her sordid tale. Trump denies it. I don't know how many people, you know, don't believe Trump's denial. There's the question of how the $130,000 got to her going through Michael Cohen. I guess the explanation from the Trump camp was Trump totally didn't have any inappropriate relationship with her, but out of fear that this was going to hurt his reputation, they settled and had a non-disclosure agreement for something that totally didn't happen, and that Michael Cohen initially claimed that he had paid out of his pocket the $130,000. So there was no financial trail heading back to Trump. The non-disclosure agreement didn't use any of their real names. Avenatti pops up on cable news suddenly all the time. Like, you really think he's just sleeping overnight on the couch in the green room at CNN. And okay, you know, there's this legal fight going on with Stormy Daniels. I think even most Trump critics would agree that the Stormy Daniels issue isn't really the biggest or most consequential allegation of wrongdoing on the part of the president. I think most people would even argue the emoluments clause and whether, you know, foreign countries are booking events at Trump hotels as a backdoor way of buying influence with the president is a slightly more serious and consequential thing. In the end, we all kind of knew who Trump was, and we're not all that surprised if he ended up doing something with Stormy Daniels. My suspicion is that Trump's interest in keeping her quiet had less to do with the campaign remember, all this is after the Access Hollywood tape came out. It's not that anybody's surprised Trump was sleeping around. My suspicion is that this is going to cause Trump grief with Melania, and that's why he wanted this kept under wraps. Avenatti shows up and is suddenly doing interviews all the time. And what kind of struck me, I was heading up to the NRA convention a couple weeks ago, Greg, there was the report that Michael Cohen had been wiretapped. And I believe it was MSNBC had it, and it was, everybody was, sirens blaring, and this was this giant, huge news. And Avenatti appeared, and he started talking about what the law enforcement had heard on these wiretaps of Michael Cohen. And then all of a sudden, NBC came out and said, well, actually, wait a second, it wasn't a wiretap, it was a pen and pad transcript. Basically, they did not record the calls, they recorded who called when, and what numbers and stuff like that. So if law enforcement was not actually conducting full-fledged listening in wiretaps, Greg, I don't know about you, I'm wondering how Avenatti could know what was on those wiretaps if they never actually happened. Making me think Avenatti is a BS artist, that he's basically making this stuff up, that he's basically just going on there and offering the most salacious stuff he can because he knows TV producers can't resist. Everybody leans forward. Everybody's excited. Everybody's, oh my God, this is really juicy. And nobody really cares that much whether it checks out or not. Now, maybe that's a very cynical interpretation of Avenatti, but there's a sense of like, okay, why is this guy on all the time? I understand why cable news is constantly discussing Stormy Daniels, Greg. It's because they get to run either B-roll footage or photographs of Stormy Daniels. And my suspicion is that quite a few gentlemen walking by the television at the gym or by any other place suddenly stop, whoa, and they just take a second look because it's Stormy Daniels. We saw Anderson Cooper interview Stormy Daniels. And I think there were some people who found that interview a little bit tawdry, a little bit perhaps beneath the usual standards of 60 Minutes, questioning that. But Avenatti is a way of getting the story out there without actually, saying, hey, America, here's a porn star. Here's what she's saying about the president of the United States. If all of this was an effort that Avenatti wanted to become a media personality, all of a sudden the pieces start to fall into place. I believe it was James Galifano, the CNN, former FBI agent who's a CNN commentator, and I said, oh, so was this really about his client at all? And I think it's a fair question to ask if this comes to pass. Of course, he's saying he has no interest in a TV show right now. We will see how things shake out. The other thing also I would note is that Scaramucci, who had this larger-than-life personality during his 11 days at the White House, I don't know about you, Greg. I don't hear people talking about him as a TV commentator all that often. As a TV commentator, he's actually, if you want to say decaffeinated, calmer, or, not quite the larger than life, wild, charismatic, is this guy for real personality that he seemed to exhibit at the White House for that short period of time. So, no, I would not watch the show. But if Avenatti is angling for a show, a lot of stuff starts to make sense.
Yes, exactly. Michael Avenatti's got a pretty long history of working for Democrats, and that's fine. That's gainful employment. That's legal, obviously. But does it strike you odd that it's never mentioned when he's introduced or described as why he's being so aggressive in this case against the president? And I mean, any lawyer would do that. But if there had been a Republican aggressively going after Obama or Clinton, you can be sure that would be mentioned, I think, in describing who they are each time they come on the air.
I think that's the case, Greg. I think it's an astute observation. And I'd also kind of observe, Stormy Daniels has said she's not paying him, which means someone is. And so the question is, who is that person? Now, I suppose he could argue that he doesn't have any legal or moral obligation to reveal who that is. I do think it'd be really interesting to see who believes it's really important. Like we, as I mentioned earlier, we have, Trump got involved with Stormy Daniels. He's, obviously a pretty deeply flawed husband, but Melania seemingly seemed to know what she was getting into when she married him. Of all the things Trump does, this seems like a fairly, low level area of concern, but somebody wants to keep this front and center by turning this into a legal fight and paying Avenatti's bills and putting him front and center like this. What is the motive here? Who's pushing this? And like I said, if Avenatti thinks this is a way to become a star, okay, that explains a few things. If it's something else, one of the president's, somebody who really can't stand the president wants to finance this as a way of causing the president headaches, I think that's something the public would have a right to know. I'm sure Avenatti feels differently, though.
All right, let's move on to our other crazy martini, which is certainly connected to the Michael Avenatti story we just did. And that's the other side of this debate, as well as the Mueller investigation. And Rudy Giuliani's performance as the public face of President Trump's legal team in each of these situations, let's just say, Jim, it hasn't been quite playing out the way that Rudy Giuliani probably promised that it would if he was the spokesperson in this situation. I mean, he's only been on the job for a few weeks here. First of all, he told Sean Hannity that President Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen for paying off Stormy Daniels. Then it got walked back to, well, he just reimbursed his lawyer for anything that might come up. Doesn't mean Cohen actually told him what it was about. I do this all the time for my clients at my law firm. Then he's going to meet with Mueller. Then he's not going to meet with Mueller. Then it might be with Mueller. Then he's going to refuse a subpoena from Mueller. The latest thing is there might not have been an FBI informant in the Trump campaign, when after pointing out that there seemed to be evidence that there was an informant in the campaign. And of course, the other night he said that the Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016 was not collusion because they didn't use the information. I think there's a pretty strong case that it's not collusion for other reasons. But to put it simply, Rudy's not helping.
Well, when you say not helping, Greg, not helping who? whom, I suppose. You know, I've been a fan of Rudy Giuliani. I grew up in New Jersey, you know, in the 1980s, in the days of Bernie Getz, and back when Al Sharpton weighed 300 pounds and was wearing tracksuits and gold chains. He did a lot to clean up New York City, and I think he always will have a great regard for him in that category. I would also note that those days in the 1980s, when Rudy was deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration, might have been the last time Rudy Giuliani worked for somebody else or answered to somebody else as an employee. He's obviously run his own firm, but he's been mayor. Rudy Giuliani has gotten very used to speaking for himself and not checking with anyone before he says something. And I think it shows it in this case. And I think you're right that he basically has caused, I don't know whether he's caused Trump more headaches than he's solved, or if you know, knowing Trump's combativeness, that he actually kind of likes this. We've seen some changes in the Trump legal team. My sense is that you don't want to see a lot of churn in your legal defenders. That if you've got, maybe if you're not happy with one, fine. But my suspicion is that you don't want to, don't change horses in the middle of a stream. You probably don't want to overhaul your legal team in the middle of a defense. But on the other hand, clearly Trump believes that this is very much a public relations fight as much as a legal fight. And he wanted somebody out there who's pugnacious. And by golly, Rudy Giuliani is pugnacious. The other thing is that I think Rudy Giuliani has gotten into the habit of calling it as he sees it so much that he doesn't recognize when he's saying or doing something that isn't necessarily helpful to his clients. And, talking about the comments, the payments to Cohen and things like that. We all remember that kind of awkward silence from Sean Hannity when he just said, oh, yeah, he reimbursed him for that. Oh, he did, and Hannity like, wait a minute, I wasn't told that. I talked to Trump all the time. And the second thing that I kind of love, and I think it was Michael Brendan Doherty who observed this, and I think he grew up in the New York City area as well, there is a certain body language that Rudy exhibits and that certain people exhibit that communicates a lot beyond their words. And at one point he said, when that first interview with Hannity, where Giuliani is discussing the allegations against Trump and with Cohen, the idea of the money going through him to pay off Stormy Daniels and things like that, the whole body language is, well, look, it's bad, but it's not indictable, And so, which I added is like, what are you going to do? It's kind of the subtext of that. It's kind of a half shrug, turn the head, raising the eyebrows. Look, it's a mess. There's no two ways about it. What are you going to do? And that's kind of this, on the one hand, it's very entertaining. It's very clear why the television networks want to have Giuliani as often as possible. I'm not sure he's necessarily helping or simplifying the defense. And I don't know whether the idea was like, okay, well, Mueller's coming up against us. It's all former prosecutors. We need a former prosecutor of our own. It's just generally turned into just about every interview Giuliani does, some new complication or headache or contradiction comes to pass out of Giuliani's statements, but Trump has kept him in place. So, maybe our ability to detect chaos in Trump world is now just totally broken.
Well, I like the way that you started that response, Jim, as well as the rest of the response. But I think it is important to remember that Rudy should be applauded for his time as New York City mayor for cleaning up the city, certainly crime-wise, and his leadership in the days and months following 9/11 is obviously to be commended long term. But any time that your clarification statements are starting to match your number of media appearances, I think that's the equivalent of getting ratioed on Twitter. That's probably not a good thing.
What I meant to say when I was apologizing, explaining what I meant to say was, there you
go. Yes. Jim, have a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
It is finally Friday. See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.